Hello, welcome to the Long Shot Leaders Podcast. I'm Michael Stein. My guest today is Hollywood royalty, writer, director, actor, Carl Gottlieb. Carl wrote the movie that changed cinema history, Jaws. He also wrote The Jerk, Caveman, and many others. His career spans 60 years of writing, directing, producing, acting, and he is part of the landscape that is film history. It was my honor that I got to play conversational tennis with this cinematic giant. Here is Carl Gottlieb. All right, here we are with Carl Gottlieb. And the first question I have, it's just the thing that I want to go back to the beginning, it crossed my mind. Your mother was a medical assistant of sorts, right? Your dad was an engineer. And what did they say? What is Carl Mashugana? He wants to be an actor? What happened?
Nothing like that. My parents, the great thing I loved about my parents, turns out that they were really good at parenting. And I didn't know that until my sister and I have been compared notes as to how we were raised compared to how everybody else we know was raised. And apparently our parents did a lot of things right. And my father's advice, if I had any fatherly advice at all, it was, do what you want to do. Don't do what you have to do. Because he was an engineer and he wanted to build bridges and he was a civil engineer. And it was the height of the Depression. And he had a kid on the way, me.
And you're the oldest.
He took a safe job working in the civil service and never did go build dams and bridges, but wound up behind a desk in the municipal building in New York in the city planning division and being, a civil service functionary and didn't get to do what he wanted until he retired. And then he developed pancreatic cancer and died soon after. So he never got to enjoy his retirement to the fullest extent. But his advice was, do what you want to do. And the one decision that I remember making when I got out of college, I graduated in midwinter because I had transferred and I had to make up a few credits. Anyway, I got out of school. It was January. There was no ceremony. It was just one day I was in college. The next day I wasn't. And I remember saying to myself, I'm only going to work in show business. I'm not going to be a cab driver or a carpenter or merchant marine. I'm not going to do any of those other jobs. I'm only going to work in show business. I'm only going to work with it. And whether I get paid or not, that's immaterial. And for, first couple of years, I worked as a techie. I was a stage manager, did lights and sound in Greenwich Village. And but I always worked in show business. I never worked at anything else. And one job led to another. And then here we are, 60 years later.
Was their first, it's a long career. Was your first big break was the Smothers Brothers? Or was that, would you say, the big one?
My first big break was The Committee.
That was before the Smothers Brothers.
Yeah. Well before.
That was in San Francisco?
63. I got out of the Army. I was in the Army. I got out of the Army in 63. My friend Larry Hankin had just joined the committee. It was a brand new theater. They had just opened, and they needed a stage manager. So I took the job. I went to San Francisco, and I was a stage manager for the committee. And I appeared briefly in sketches. And then they went to do Broadway, and I directed the company in the meantime. And then they came back from Broadway and I went back to being a stage manager. And then I figured it was a dead end job. So I went to Broadway, went back to New York and worked for the New York producer of the committee in his office. And one thing led to another. I just, eventually went back to the committee as an actor in 66. And then the show was a huge hit. And then we went to L.A. in 68 and opened the show in Los Angeles. And again, we were a big hit. It was amazing. We got rave reviews from Daily Variety, the trades, the two daily newspapers, the Herald Examiner and the L.A. Times, and the alternative press, the L.A. Free Press and the L.A. Weekly. So we got across the board raves, and we were a hot ticket. We were playing up on the Sunset Strip, and it was the summer of love, and everything was going great. And the Smothers Brothers came and saw the show and asked me if I wanted to work as a writer. Because in improv theater, you know, if you say it, you probably, you know, you made it up. So they hired a bunch of new writers to do the Glen Campbell summer show. And that little group of writers was me, Steve Martin, Mason Williams, Bob Einstein, John Hartford, Murray Roman. Steve Martin?
Yeah. Heck of a group. I mean, Einstein.
It was a great group, and we won the Emmy that year. So we all got picked up. First, we did the Glen Campbell summer show, and then we got picked up for the Smothers show, and we did the Smothers show, and won an Emmy, and then one thing led to another. And then eventually I did the Fish movie.
Yeah. Well, but before that, then you did was the Bob Newhart show, right?
Yeah, I did it as an actor, and I did it as I think I wrote an episode with George Yannick.
Now, that's interesting because I met Bob a couple times. He's kind of dry, and you seem like you're a little bit more jovial and, you know, personable.
While I was working on the Smothers Brothers show, or the Glen Cam, one of those shows, Bob was a guest on the show. And I was writing partners with Lorenzo Music, you know, Garfield the Cat. And anyway, Lorenzo and I wrote a monologue for Newhart that was part of a larger sketch, but the larger sketch disappeared. Had too many production values, but we kept the monologue, and he did it. He performed it, and then he liked it so much, he asked us if he could use it in his act. And we said yes, so he bought it from us. He paid us good money and did it in his act for a long time. And then Lorenzo parlayed that into writing the pilot for the Newhart show. I wasn't asked to do the pilot because Lorenzo had a different writing partner by that time, Dave Davis. But they created the Newhart show based on the association, the favorable association that Newhart had from the monologue. So.
And now after that, it seems like you're on a roll because then you was at the Flip Wilson show. And Flip Wilson was like a huge, big star. If I recall,
yes.
I was a kid. I was.
Yeah, no, I did Newhart. Then I think I may have gone, what did I do? I did commercials for a while. And I went to, in 70. Four anyway. Anyway, I wound up going to the Vineyard to work on Jaws as a writer. Then I came back, and it was a year before Jaws would be released. I had to keep working, so I got a job on this Flip Wilson show, and did four Flip Wilson specials. First one of which was produced by Lord Michaels, and we got on very well. And Flip's guests on that first show were Lily Tomlin and Peter Sellers and Richard Pryor. So I was having a great time writing for good people.
And is this around the same time that also you worked with Altman?
Yeah, well, in 68, I did the movie of MASH.
Yeah, okay.
Because we opened in L.A., we were a hit, and then we started getting raided by people who wanted us to do stuff. And one of the things that we did was, like I said, I did the Flip Wilson shows.
So at this whole time, like, you know, right around that era, what was your major want that you found yourself just saying, this is what I really want. This is what I want, like, just not work-wise, but also just the primary want that you had at that time, your mindset?
All I wanted to do was work. I wanted to make entertainment. That was my goal. Work as a writer, work as an actor, as a producer, as a director, you know, just do funny stuff. And I was lucky enough to be able to get to do that. So, and one thing led to another, you know, one job led to another.
Is it safe to say that you kind of like write like an actor? Because you were an actor first, your dialogue seems very much like good acting dialogue, as to put like a David Mamet is the less acting dialogue.
Well, in my opinion, in my professional opinion, the hardest things to do in screenwriting or television writing, two hardest things to do are exposition and dialogue. And you have to have an ear for dialogue. And if you're going to do comedy, by the time you know what a sense of humor is, it's too late to acquire one. So you've got to be kind of, you know, instinctively funny. But, you know, I guess, you know, Altman saw that and he hired me, and I did MASH, And then when that was over, but by that time I was established, you know, kind of.
Yeah, I would think, you know, that's kind of like, you know.
After the Flip Wilson show, Lauren, in the meantime, had gotten Saturday Night Live and was going to go to New York to start the show. And he asked me, it's the only career decision I ever thought about twice. He asked me if I would go to New York and be the senior writer. I guess it was the job that Herb Sargent had on the original Saturday Night Live.
I think you did okay. You got it. You can't do everything.
So I agonized over that decision, and he said, "We'll get a job for Allison. You know, my wife would join me, so I'd have to relocate to New York." And I thought about it, but by that time I had already done Jaws. I had a movie in the can, not released, but finished, and I was doing another movie with Richard Pryor. So by the time,
which movie?
Which Way Is Up?
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So by 1975, by the time the first year of First Five, when the golden Lorne Michaels Saturday Night Live years were over, everybody showed up in L.A. to work. And I already had two features done and I had a career. So in retrospect, it was the right decision. But it would have been fun to have been in New York for that first 5 years.
Oh, man. Yeah.
That cast had the best of everything. They were a national success, you know, so they had media credibility, and they were the hottest ticket in New York for live theater, because it was, you know, the 30 Rock was a little 150 seat venue and they were sold out every Saturday night. So they had the best of both worlds. They were the hottest Broadway ticket there was, and they were nationally recognized as television stars. So it was good, and it was corrosive. I sold a sketcher to them, and I used to visit whenever I was in New York. I'd go watch a taping, you know, reconnect with my old friends, and I was pals with Belushi. So, you know, it was, they were good times. You know, it was nice to be part of the comedy establishment that way.
Sure, sure. Well, you had the pedigree from, you know, the committee and all that, but this is right around the crossroads where you can't second guess that decision, because then you got the opportunity at the crossroads of Jaws, you know. So let's go before that, though, with the relationship that kind of built up to the apex of, you know, the beginning of that, getting how it started to form your decision-making towards that.
It was all part of my, you know, all I want to do is make show business. I would take whatever job came along, and the jobs were good jobs. And, you know, I could have, when I got the movie of MASH, some other people in the committee were hired to do Viva Max, which was a movie with Peter Ustinov, and Jerry Paris directed it. And that was less successful. You know, that was not a successful movie, but I was lucky. MASH was, you know, MASH was MASH. It was a huge hit.
Oh, yeah.
But they didn't hire any of us to do the TV show except for Gary Berghoff.
And why is that? Just different.
Who knows what? Who knows what he had on them?
Yeah. So now your decision making is, was it just Jaws came along before, you know, Saturday Night Live, or, you know, what was the decision?
Spielberg and I had the same agent, a guy named Mike Medavoy, who was very early hooked onto the idea of synergy and packaging. And he had signed a bunch of really interesting clients. I mean, besides me, he has signed Medavoy's class of 68 included me, John Milius, Carol Eastman, Michelangelo Antonioni. It was a really, really, really sterling actors. So he teamed me up with Spielberg. And Spielberg and and Spielberg was the new kid in town. So I was kind of, I won't say mentoring him, but he was new in L.A. and I had a kind of an established scene going. I had something of a salon in my house. You know, people would come over to my house and hang out. I was conveniently located halfway between Laurel Canyon and Wally Heider Studios and the Hollywood Bowl. So people would hang out at the house and Steven would hang out. Mike Medavoy was a hustling agent at CAA who liked to put his clients together. He was like the very earliest guy into packaging. And he teamed me up with Steven Spielberg. And Steven and I tried to sell stories together. We pitched scripts together. I just found a couple of them. There's some pretty good stories, but we couldn't sell anything because Stephen would have to be locked in as director and nobody would take the chance. So we never sold anything, but we got to know each other. And I acted in two of Stephen's television movies. I was in Something Evil, which was a precursor to The Exorcist. And I was in a movie called The Savage Report, which was a pilot for a Martin Landau, Barbara Bain series that Stephen directed. And then he came to me and said, I'm going to be doing this movie about a shark for Zanuck and Brown. You should meet them. So I met with Stephen and Zanuck and Brown, and they said, you know, you're talking about an extensive rewrite, and the script had already been rewritten a couple of times, and Stephen said it needed a rewrite. So I was hired first as an actor to be in the movie. Is kind of to be just available to Stephen to help with the local actors, because we knew we would be using a lot of local actors, non-professionals. And I, you know, my improv background enabled me to work with them. So I was hired as an actor, and then they hired me as to do the rewrite with 3 weeks before principal photography started. Stephen and I tore the script apart, and I started writing, and we went to the Vineyard together and started casting and found, at that point, we only had Roy Scheider. We didn't have Robert Shaw. We did not have, what's his name? We didn't have Dreyfuss. But I knew Dreyfuss from
improv. Yeah, I love in your book. I love
LA.
In your book how you call him Ricky.
Anyway, one thing. Yeah, well, that's who he was.
And he was with you at the committee too,
days.
Right?
Yes, well, he and Rob Reiner had a little improv company of their own in L.A. called, and Rob was in the committee for a while too.
What year was that?
In the L.A. company.
67. I think that was Dreyfuss's first role where he's, did you go, I'm going to call the cops. I'll call the cops. And which is a big line in The Graduate.
Yeah. That was when Ricky said he was in the best and the worst pictures of that year. He was in The Graduate and he was in a movie called Glub Glub or Hello Down There, which was a movie about a bunch of young people who were living in an underwater residence, as an underwater place.
That's good
place.
Foreshadowing for what was going to come about 7 years later.
Yes. So you know, Richard needed an actor like him, and I was able to get him to come up and talk to Stephen, and they got on very well. And then I started writing, and I was rewriting. If I wasn't acting, I was rewriting or writing. And when the smoke and dust cleared, I qualified for a screenplay credit, and the rest is history.
And, you know, we don't have to get into total into the Jaws, because I think people that want to know more about the Jaws, I think Brian Singer had it perfectly. This is your book, The Jaws Log. And
yes,
yeah,
thank you for
this. This book is awesome. It's going to look backwards here, but it's The Jaws Log is basically anybody who wants to be a filmmaker, just anybody that's a fan of that movie, they should just read that. And I thought it'd be fun. Not to some talk about the production and all that. What I would like to talk about and would be fun is the personalities that were in the show, like Zanuck and Verna, her notorious job on the editing and all that. But personalities being stuck on this shoot for so long and the personality differences. That's something, not to make to tell us any dirt, unlike, but relationships go through whole roller coaster rides on that kind of those conditions. And you guys were very close on that shoot. You guys were like, you know, she would sit on meetings like you talk about in the book. You guys are stuck with each other for a long time. A lot of the personalities getting on each other's nerves a little bit.
Oh, yeah. It was fraught, that shoot was. And I was literally living with Stephen. We shared a house in the Vineyard. So, you know, we slept, you know, in opposite ends of the house, but we would meet for meals and dinner, and I would have a little desk where I was writing during the day while they were off shooting. Or if I was working that day as an actor, I would go and shoot. And Verna was cutting in her hotel room, and Zanuck or Brown were around, and they would come in and visit. And every night we'd have dinner at the log cabin. The whole point of having the house is Stephen had learned a lesson on Sugarland Express. You know, the director is obviously very well taken care of in any kind of Hollywood production. It's all about the director. But he realized that there's a lot of time is wasted at the end of the day. When you finish shooting, then you got to, everybody goes back to the hotel and showers, then you meet, and then you got to decide where you're going to go for dinner. And, you know, if you can't get to a decision, you just have to eat in the hotel, and that's usually less than optimal. And the Jaws production was a classic studio location production with a crew of 30 or 40 or 50 people, plus local hires and a local production office and this infrastructure. And the Vineyard, which was full of a lot of rich people who had paid a lot of money for their property, they were not happy to see us there, some of them. And the Vineyard was divided amongst people who thought that a movie location company was a good thing and a sizable part of the population that thought it was an encroachment and interfered with their peaceful enjoyment of the island's resort capabilities.
Do you have challenges doing the rewrites on that thing when there's so much pandemonium going on and you're trying to concentrate on dialogue and script and picking up the pieces?
You know, at the time, I repeat this whenever I'm given the opportunity. At the time, for everybody, it was a job. It was a studio movie. There was a grip department, an electric department, a prop department. The art department, Joe Alves was kind of trying to keep the shark working. There was a lot going on, but it was, like I say, it was a studio movie. They weren't doing anything that movies hadn't already been doing for 100 years. You know, they would take a company, go on location. It's not new. So then, you know, there was, like I say, it was local friction. There was the Boston Teamsters were difficult to work with because that was a mobbed up union at the time. So everybody was doing their best within the framework of a studio movie. Departments worked for their department heads. The studio would fret over the budget. Steven wanted to get it right, so he worked hard to get things the way he wanted to. And sometimes that, you know, we went over budget and over schedule. And everybody was fretting, and there was a concern that they were going to shut us down and move us back to L.A. and just put the movie out in any shape they could just to retrieve the negative cost. But in the end, it all worked out.
Of course. Absolutely. So that time, though, when you were out there, let's talk about maybe some moments you had. What are some of your fond moments with Verna? Start with her.
Well, Verna was able to cut sequences because she was working in her hotel or next, you know, she had the editing table in her hotel room. So as soon as a sequence was completed, she could start cutting it and show it to Steven. So, you know, so she would. And Steven could go and quibble about it, and Zanuck and Brown would put in their 2 cents. But she was extremely understanding, and she was the one who would come to dinner most often with us, where we would discuss what had happened that day on the set, and then what were we going to do the next day? What was in the works? Were those pages finished yet, or did I have to stay up late and finish writing pages? Or I could read the pages at the dinner table, and Steven would say, oh, good, okay, put that into Mimeo. And over at the production office, the secretaries would show up at 4 in the morning and type stencils, if you remember stencils, and they'd mimeograph the pages and hand them out to the crew first thing in the morning at 7 a.m.
There are no Final Cut Pro.
At the crew, you know, no. This is all stencils, corrections. It was...
So you got all these interesting personalities going on. You, if I could take a guess, if I had to, just watching you and your dialogue around that time and knowing the history of you and knowing that you're writing, you seem like you were a formidable person, you know, as far as your personality, smart, formidable. Now, as far as the other personalities colliding in this family, I understand it's a business, but it was such a... Would you say that it was one of the more longer, challenging shoots that you've had, that you've worked on?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've never worked on a picture that went double the budget and know that, you know, at the time.
I don't think The Jerk had that problem. And
no, The Jerk was.
And Caveman and all that other.
Yeah, no. Everything else was, you know, it was interesting that my first picture was one of such monumental challenges in terms of, you know, finishing, getting pages done on time, writing for actors. The beauty of it was I was writing for actors who I interacted with every day. I mean, if I wrote a line of dialogue,
right,
I could be assured that Richard would say it. in Richard's voice, because I had their voices down. I mean, there were times I've had this happen. It happened in television too, but you know, you write something and you get it right, you get it correct. Then the actor wants to make it their own, so they start ad-libbing, and the dialogue isn't as good because it's hard to make up dialogue on the spot. You know, it's writing is writing, and I don't think everybody appreciated how much writing went into the creation of that script. And a lot of times I would have to read up.
Well, you're the synergy. You've got the synergy down with, like, the actor /writer synergy. You nailed that. I mean, even the line you deliver when you deliver, you know, it, just you saying the one line, it's happened before. When you say that line, I'm like, that's an actor. And the way you write, it just sounds like an act, like the actor's voice is in your head as you're writing that dialogue, as opposed to conceptual, right? Rather than thinking concept, you're thinking emotions and the rhythm of dialogue.
Yeah, I am. At that moment, you know, I'm a character in a movie, but I've got in the back of my head, I've got the demands of the script. We have, you know, we have story points to make. Every line of dialogue in a movie, there's no extraneous dialogue. I mean, if actors take the time to say it in a film, it better contribute to the, you know, movement of the plot or the story or the exposition. And that was the challenge, is, you know, trying to make stuff up, but at the same time have it be appropriate. I mean, there's a long ad lib on the scene on the dock with the shark, where I'm trying to get them to line up for a photo. Well, I'm making all that up as I go along, but I know who the character is, and I know what the intention of the scene is. I know what I have to do. I know what the actors have to do. I know what the locals have to do. So I'm trying to pull it all together. And Stephen is, you know, standing just off camera, behind the camera, recording it all and suggesting other things to do. It was a great way.
There is left and right. There's unique dialogue volleys. And I don't know whether it's improv. So, you know, when Shaw comes up to Hooper, or comes up to Dreyfus, says, "Jesus H. Christ, when I was a kid," he's like, you know, and then he goes the whole thing. You go in the cage go in the water, sharks in the water, our shark. You go through that. That's a rhythm. That was that your dialogue? Was that
no? That was or, you know, what was the actors kind of playing in the moment, and I was on the set for that. So they would say, "Can I say this?" I'd say, "Yeah, you know, yeah, say that. That's good." Or don't say that. Say it. This, you know, we would. It was very collaborative. I think the Indianapolis speech is the most interesting example of that, because everybody was nervous about that speech ever since it first appeared in the Sackler draft. And it was, Stephen was asking all his friends to take a crack at it, you know, John Milius and Willard Hike and Gloria Katz and, you know, just everybody, Landis, everybody took a stab at that. And then, as I say in the book, Shaw took all the pieces together, and everybody forgets that Shaw has like 5 published novels and won a Pulitzer Prize for a play called The Man in the Glass Booth. So, you know, Shaw is a writer as well as an actor and a gifted writer. So he basically wrote the speech the way you see it.
And then kind of Verna kind of, like, you know, kind of saved it a little bit too, right?
Yeah. And you know, Verna did her
2 days of different shoots for that monologue. Yeah. So that was a big thing for Spielberg, wasn't it? Because that was his, you know, homage to his dad, you know, being in the military somewhat, sort of. That's what I've always heard. Kind of a sentimental monologue, you know, about World War II and the Indianapolis.
No.
I got that one wrong.
I mean, over the years, there's...
Sounds romantic.
No, you got to remember, Spielberg's first movie shot on Super 8 in Phoenix, Arizona, when he was like 12 years old, was a war movie. It was, there were fighter planes. I guess it was an airplane graveyard somewhere outside of Phoenix that Spielberg went to, and he could climb into an airplane with a Super 8 and shoot pretend war footage, draw in bombs and machine guns and stuff. So, you know, he was always fascinated by that.
So we can get into more on Jaws, but I'll show the book one more time. If you guys want to really find out everything about Jaws, get the Jaws log. we want to move on with your story and your life, you know, after that. And then we get into the film's done. It turns into, you know, this monolith of, like, you know, the first major blockbuster. We're not talking Wizard of Oz blockbuster. We're talking merchandising, first time in history to pave the way for Star Wars and historical and pantheons of cinema. This was an original type of film like never seen. Yeah. And you're a part of that. And then right after that, I saw that one of your first gigs after that was Mork and Mindy.
I was working as an actor. So I worked on Mork and Mindy as an actor. I directed an episode of Laverne and Shirley. I knew the whole Gary Marshall gang over at Paramount. I had been a staffer. When I left L.A. to do Jaws, I was employed as story editor on The Odd Couple with Jack Klugman and Tony Randall. And I quit that job on one day's notice and went to Boston to make Jaws. But I had a career down in those days. You've got to remember, everybody in television wanted to be in movies, and everybody in movies wanted to be in rock and roll, and everybody in rock and roll wanted to be in movies. Everybody wanted to do something else. But the hierarchy was television was like, you know, ordinary, and the aristocracy did movies. Now it's changed. All the people who are doing movies can't wait to get a series. They understand. They finally understood that the money is in television, not in movies.
I just find it ironic. You were at the apex of, like, historical, you know, this movie. And then you go on to Robin Williams, who's a juggernaut for what he was doing. And you slip right into that. And then you got the jerk.
Yep. I mean,
you're the old buddy.
If I was a Jeopardy category, it would be his hits begin with a J. But I remember at the time, like I say, they were jobs. I was doing a job. And everything that happened after that was out of my control. You can't make an iconic film. You can't buy an opening weekend. And Jaws was such a phenomenon that, you know, all you could do was just, you know, get out of the way, you know, and circumstances unfold.
Well, then listening to your priorities right now, after that came out, you're like, well, I got job security for a long time. You must have felt that then, because that was a priority.
There was a tendency. Spielberg was very concerned with being Steven Spielberg. He understood that he was a brand.
Interesting.
He understood that before anybody else. And as an example, he went from Jaws to Close Encounters was his next film. And when I went to do Jaws 2, he was prepping Close Encounters. He didn't like to share the credit. When I wrote the Jaws log, I showed him the typescript, the manuscript, ahead of time. He approved it, made a change or two. And then a few months went by, and then the book was finished, and it came out, and they shipped a box to Universal. And Steven opened the book and looked through it and threw it across the room. He was in Werner's office, the Jaws log.
The Jaws log.
Threw it across the room.
Why is that?
Because in between the time he made the movie and the time the movie came out, he was very invested in being Steven Spielberg. And the book is specific evidence that there were other creative forces involved. Now, in the book, I say it's the author. He's the auteur. It's all his serving his vision. You know, I don't claim any primacy. I didn't say, you know, I thought of this first. I didn't do any of that. I was just serving the picture. I was doing what I like to do, which is put the project first. But Steven didn't like to share creative credit. And you can see that in Close Encounters. Steven did a lot of press and interviews about what a fucking genius Doug Trumbull was with the special effects, the opticals. The genius on Close Encounters was Joe Alves, who designed the spaceship, found the location in Alabama or Georgia where they could film it. He found a used Navy hangar, which is a large enclosure. He designed Devil's Tower. Obviously, he designed the shark. And when the credits roll for Close Encounters, Joe gets just like the statutory single card, but he's not recognized for his contribution. Stephen didn't like to acknowledge that anybody else had something to do with major creative elements. Doug Trumbull, fine. Everybody knew Stephen was not an optical, was not a special effects wizard. He understood special effects, but he let Doug Trumbull do them. But he didn't like to share the creative credit.
Is that a common tale, you know, more often than not, or, you know, throughout your career experiencing, you know, that in Hollywood, sometimes being parsimonious with accolades, sometimes if they felt threatened of the spotlight?
Directors are particularly vulnerable because it used to be the director was an employee who could be hired and fired, and the director was not God King. Directors were replaced, you know, relatively, not routinely, but they were replaced. They were, you know, producers made movies. But then when the collapse of the studio system and the strong producer offices, you know, kind of closed, there was nobody left to make decisions except the director. Right. So the director became God King. Ask the director.
Because of the writer he created.
Now,
that's right.
The opposite was true in television. In television, the creator of the show, the writer, is God King in television, which is as it should be. But in movies, you know, directors want to be the big cheese, and the system encourages that. And the Directors Guild has strong rules about replacing directors and giving credit. So it's all designed to reinforce the director's position as the ultimate authority.
I always thought that was crazy that the writer didn't get more respect, you know, because they're the ones that are writing it. I, not to mention my film, I have a film called Love Hollywood Style with Faye Dunaway and Andy Dick, a crazy film. But the director yells at the, you know, because the writer says, hey, hey, he comes on set and says, I didn't write that. He goes, what the hell? Who's this? He goes, I'm the writer. He goes, what are you doing? He's like, get him out of here. He's like, well, how many times do I have to tell you? The director yells at his assistant, never let the writer on the set. To me, it was my homage to, like, you know, being a Hollywood cadfly, I guess, because I just hate the fact that it's always been like that, that the writer doesn't have that hierarchy when he wrote the damn thing.
Well, that was the beauty of the Fish movie, is I was on the set. They couldn't keep me off the set because I was in the movie and I was living with Spielberg. So I was part of it. And we were writing so close to the gun that nobody could rewrite me because, you know, when it came out of my typewriter, it went to the actors and they said the words. It went from my typewriter to the set with no intervening, you know, notes to speak of.
And look how great that movie came out.
Yeah.
I did all right.
Every now and then the system works.
That's
well,
right.
I have two rules of life, which I'll share with you. The first rule of life is that it's supposed to be fun. It isn't always, but it's supposed to be. You're supposed to have a good time. And then the corollary is that every now and then things work out the way they're supposed to. You know, everybody does what they're supposed to. And the result is everybody can bask in the results because, you know, they're good. But very often, because of clashing egos and directors who want to impose their vision on the work,
right,
you know, the writers have devolved to this secondary position. And the old joke about the Polish starlet who was, you know, fucking the writers to advance their career.
Yeah. I don't know that one.
Oh, well, yes.
Is it a long one or a short one?
So writers became second-class citizens, and directors wouldn't let them on the set. Almost every enlightened director has understood the value of keeping the writer around.
Right, right. Well, speaking of another great director, what was it like being the two Carls on The Jerk, Carl Reiner and Carl Gottlieb? What was that like?
Well, that was great because, you know, Steve Martin and I had created the script, and then it was rewritten extensively by Michael Elias, and then Carl Reiner came on to direct. And that was another very happy collaboration where everything worked the way it was supposed to. Everybody brought something to the party. I had gone on to do something else, so I wasn't around for all the rewrites. But when the smoke and dust cleared, I qualified for shared story credit and shared screenplay credit. And Carl Reiner was, you know, was a writer himself. So, you know, he understood, you know, from your show of shows days, going all the way back to the beginning, and Dick Van Dyke. I mean, you know, You got to remember, Carl Reiner wrote the first two seasons of the Dick Van Dyke Show, 36 episodes, not 26, the 36 episode seasons by himself.
Yeah. No, he's a legend. I mean,
they don't make him like that anymore.
No. And now, right around this time, you were the VP of the WGA.
Yes.
At the same time?
I was very active in guild affairs. All my adult life, I was very active in the Writers Guild.
Hearing you talk about the issues between certain directors and writers and how the pride of the writer, that makes sense. I mean, to me, it's just something that would come, it's logical, you don't have to be the VP of the WGA to realize that, the value of the writer in the screenplay. But what were some of the dynamics that you look back on with the WGA stint that you had that was kind of stands out?
Well, that was interesting because in 88, I was co-chair of the negotiating committee on the longest strike we ever had.
Right.
And it turned out that was when I got to go off and write A Long Time Gone with David Crosby. I got to write that book because there was nothing happening in movies and television. So I had like a fallback gig that I could go to, which was to go out and do the research for A Long Time Gone, which I did. So, it was, like I say, a career based on happy accidents.
Well, I don't want to bend your ear too much today, but what about one last icon, George Burns, George Burns special?
Oh, yeah.
What was that like?
Obviously, that was a treat. George Burns, he's, obviously a legend. And my ex-mother-in-law was in vaudeville, and she knew all those people. And Burns, it was just we did this series called the George Burns Comedy Week. So Burns would come in for one day and shoot the wraparounds and the intros for the episodes. We'd do three or four in a day. And then he'd go away and we'd shoot the episodes or finish the episodes. And then he'd come back and he'd do four more. But he just told all these wonderful stories about vaudeville. I mean,
he and Gracie, they did vaudeville together, right?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. He was, there was only one of him.
They would say back then they broke the mold when they made George Burns.
Yeah. Well,
that's an old school saying.
It was the funny thing about Burns was when he was a young man in the Pee Wee Quartet touring as a child, he had to add a year or two to his age so that he could, because there were child labor laws even in vaudeville days. So in order to be on the road when he was 12 or 13, he had to have some sort of working papers or something filled out. So he got them done and basically kept that age. But people in vaudeville, like my mother-in-law, would say, George Burns is not as old as he says he is, because he added a couple of years to his age in 1911, so that he could tour.
Okay, and he never
retroactively came out about his real age. So he wasn't 96 or 99; he was 94.
Okay. Well, still, nice run.
Oh, yeah. And, and kind of a real interesting television figure, because the George Burns Gracie Allen show was, they broke the fourth wall. He talked to the camera. He talked to the audience.
Right.
And when they replaced an actor. It's a really great moment in television. They replaced one of the actors in the show. And while they're taping the show, George Burns comes out in one and I guess with Gracie, and talks about they got a new actor in the show and welcomes him. And then they go back into the show. This is like a show within a show format where it's about George, his home life. And so the old actor walks off stage and a new actor steps in to the sketch playing the same part. And nobody says anything except we just did that. Live with it. So it's really kind of, postmodern television before the term was even
looking it back
existed.
Well, that's like Carl Reiner, and all the other people that, looking through up people that you worked with and your own scope of work. I'm going to close up this, but it seems like everyone's susceptible to flattery, but you seem like you were always about the work. But I'm going to give you some compliments here. I grew up saying your dialogue. My wife just bought me this, and I'm going to close with this. My wife just bought me this a few weeks ago. I was putting this back for the podcast. I got these pictures back here. This is what she bought me, this Robert Shaw, you know, picture back here. And the reason why she gets me that, she's from Connecticut. The reason why she got me that is because since I've known her for like 16, 17 years, I've been doing the monologues from Jaws. I've been doing it. I did it in my first acting class. I just had Eric Morris, who's 90 years old this year, who studied, he worked with Strasberg. He's on his 12th book. And the first time I just talked to him about another episode I did. He's like, you got a monologue? And I'm like, oh, I got one from the Dirt Diggler story. I'm not going to do that. I'll just do from Jaws. I couldn't think of it. I was on the stage. And it's amazing just to have your writing repeated by so many people, that movie especially, but other movies. I was talking to somebody the other day, and how many times, like in The Jerk, you know, there's so many quotes. Godfather's quoted quite a bit, but Jaws and maybe Rocky One and The Jerk and Caddyshack, these are movies that, especially guys, they get together and they repeat the dialogue forever. And that's, your writing lives on forever because of that.
I got to say that as a writer, the thing that is most pleasing or satisfying or ego building is when it works, when you do it right, you actually create something that becomes part of the culture. You know, we're going to need a bigger boat, or he hates these cans, or, you know, the new phone books are here, or, you know, pick a line. And it becomes part of the culture. And, you know, long after I'm gone, or the movies are gone, the catchphrases and lines linger on. And they, if you scrape away at the things that people say all the time, you can eventually trace it back to some movie or radio show or television show where particularly, you know, you can't create a catchphrase. They try to do it on Saturday Night Live all the time. You can't tell the audience ahead of time that I'm going to say something now that you're going to find so delightful that you're going to repeat it forever. You know, you can't do that.
You might have a feeling that you have when you wrote it, but that's the beauty, because the old filmmaker's line is directors and writers will say, you know, once you make a movie, when you're writing it or you're directing it, it's yours. But once you put it out there, it's not yours anymore. No. Now it's everybody else's.
Yeah.
And everybody owns your dialogue. There's so many movies that you could feel just the solace. It's just out there in the stratosphere forever that people repeat those lines.
There was a writer named, she's a famous woman writer, one of the very first Mary Tyler Moore writers. She wrote Chuckles the Clown episode for Mary Tyler Moore. Oh, I forget her name. God damn it. Accomplished writer. And she was divided her time between New York and L.A., the way we do, and she would fly over the state. But one year, she was going from New York to L.A., and she said, oh, fuck it, I'm going to get off in Denver and see what the middle of the country looks like. You know, just see America a little bit. So she gets off the plane. Before she leaves the airport, she hears people saying lines of hers. She wrote for Get Smart. So she wrote Sorry About That. And so people in the airport are saying her lines of dialogue from Mary Tyler Moore, and she fled screaming back to the plane and got to LA and said, oh my God, we tell them what to say. They don't know what to say until we say it first. So unsettled her to hear her dialogue coming back to her from a lot of people who didn't even know what the origin of the line was. They didn't know what the show was or the context in which the line originally appeared. But the Maxwell Smart inflection of, sorry about that, that everybody started saying that. I just saw a piece today in the paper. There's a Shelley Duvall piece. It's, apparently she did a Dr. Phil's show where she was, appeared quite deranged. And a lot of people are doing whatever, what happened to Shelley Duvall? She's crazy. And maybe she is, but she was responsible for so much that it's kind of sad to see her deranged. She was deranged. Anyway, it happens, you know?
Well, let me button this up to wrap up here. I'll give it a button. I'll give it a call back. A denouement, whatever you want to call it. George Burns used to say, you know, like, what do you attribute to your longevity? You know, and you're still putting out good work. You know, what's your longevity? He goes, well, I can't go anywhere now. Yeah. I'm booked until, you know, the end of the year. And that's what I like to about you. I would keep on doing the great work that you're doing. You're an icon yourself. And I look forward to seeing what more you're going to do, because you're just a super great talent, and I'm thrilled to talk to you today.
Work of mine that you'll see in the years to come is mostly trunk stuff. I mean, it's stuff that I've done before that I'm just going to have to wait for people to rediscover it. Writing is lonely and difficult and hard, and I don't like to do it. So
bring out and open up that trunk then. That's good.
Yeah, no, I have opened the trunk. I've got some of those Spielberg screenplay ideas that I can go out and sell.
Carl, it was great today. And I look forward to seeing all that. And I loved it, our conversation today. And thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm a little old and tired now and feeling my years. But
you look great. Oh, you look fantastic.
Yeah. You're
sharp as a tack.
Yes. I'm lucky that way.
You are. You know, one last thing I'll say. You, when I said you're formidable, you know, my mother was a very formidable woman. You know, she's very quick, witty. She looked like Marilyn Monroe. That's her in the towel right there, right up there in that picture right there. That's my sexy mother. She looked like Marilyn Monroe, and her personality was like the guy that you see to your right over there, Don Rickles. And you have that sharpness. Even, you know, when you play your character, even in Jaws, if anybody want to look at, you know, Carl Gottlieb in the movie right there, look at his... That comes out in your writing. Your writing was sharp. It was witty. It was fast and clever. And your personality is like that. So, and you're still like that now. So I'm a fan, and I think you bring out the trunk stuff and just show it to everybody. And I think that would be great.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there anything else you want to, you know, promote a little bit right here?
Reach out to garlicbottle@gmail.com. Tell me your ideas.
Garlic bottle. Go to garlic bottle.
Garlicbottle@gmail.com.
Then, you know, why garlic bottle?
It's an anagram for Carl Gottlieb.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Okay. I knew it had to be something like that.
Yeah.
I should have caught that. See? Sharp. See? All right.
All right.
A pleasure.
Thank you a lot, Michael.
Thank you.
Be well.
That was fun. To be a part of the movies that he was a part of. I mean, a lot of people don't know, but Jaws was like what Muhammad Ali did for sports, Jaws did for cinema. The merchandising that went into Jaws post the movie, no one ever saw anything like that. And it really changed the way we do movies today with P&A and a lot of other aspects of it. We could have got more heavy into Jaws, but I figured... just get the Jaws log. It'll be on our website in our book section, so check it out. There was just too many other aspects to his career that a lot of people don't know about that we just had to get into, find so fascinating and interesting. Carl Gottlieb, one of the most quoted screenplay writers in history. All right. If you want to find out more about our show, go to longshotleaders.com. If you want to be a part of something special and get your daily dose of inspiration, perspiration, exasperation, knowledge, and creativity, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to our podcast. And if you like what we do, share our show with your family and your friends, and put some positivity out there in the world. Thank you for listening. And until we meet again on the next episode, I bid you adieu. Where did I get French from?